Welcome to Tilth Talk Radio. Today we've got a special interview episode for you, joined once again by Dr. John Gazer. But with me today, as normal, is Bill Schomburg.
Hey guys.
Todd Schomburg.
Hey to all the Tilties out there.
And I'm Matt Brueger, all with Tilth Agronomy. All right, so with us today is Dr. John Gazer, who is the Director of Nutritional Research and Innovation with Rock River Labs in Watertown, Wisconsin. John also serves as Adjunct Assistant Professor, Animal and Dairy Science Department, University of Wisconsin-Madison. He is a consultant with Cows Agree Consulting, and he has a background in agronomy and plant breeding. So welcome, John.
Thank you, guys. Pleasure to get together and rip it up with you all again. Lots of topics out there on people's minds, so look forward to wading into anything and everything cropping for dairy and beef cattle today.
Yeah, thanks, John, for being here. It seems like you're out on the speaking circuit a lot right now, so I'm sure it's been a quite a year. What's your busiest speaking time? Is it right now or is it the winter?
Good question. It ebbs and flows. So last week was a different week in that I did back-to-back-to-back midday webinars centered in and around our corn crop for silage. It was fantastic opportunity to hopefully have an impact or get some thoughts out there. Todd, thanks to you in part and a number of other agronomists I talked to in different regions throughout the country. Put some heavy-hitting content hopefully together. Of course, I always reserve the right to be completely wrong, I'll probably be at least half wrong on some of my speculation and projections put out there. But yeah, last week was a little bit different week in terms of the speaking engagement intensity. I don't know. I mean, it ebbs and flows. I can't forecast anything. And that coming from the mouth of a guy that was forecasting silage quality just last week and today with you all, but
it ebbs and flows. It's got to be hard in July and August to predict when it's not even in a bunker yet of feed quality and what this crop is. And we do a lot of, say, yield checks and some of that right now and predictions. And that is always the difficult part, is you are going to be wrong because you can't be 100% right, but at least you shot your shot and hopefully it's right. And you've got the research to back it up. So that's good.
Yeah. Well, there are going to be some things that we can talk about today with some certainty. And then some other things that are certainly more speculative on my behalf. Hey, I got to come back though to my, Matt, appreciate the introduction. I've got, I guess, a number of affiliations, associations, but I can't get enough of it. So I added a new credential behind my name. So you guys, you want to raise your hand if you're a technical service provider?
Oh,
TSPs on the call today.
That's not easy anymore.
It is not.
I mean, no. Way years ago, we went through all the work when Plinsky was still around to get it. And then actually kind of let it expire, and it's a lot of work to get it back. So I give you props there, John. I haven't found the time to get mine, back in action.
I'm doing a little bit of work in and around the carbon world. And Matt, you and I were at a professional dairy producers organized event.
Yep.
About a couple of weeks ago, right? Centered on carbon crops and cows, oriented toward agronomists, soil scientists. But Bill, to your point, I spent way more time, and I did it because of a research project that I'm tied in with. I obtained the first TSP credentials of any nutritionist in Wisconsin for Conservation Practice Standard 592 as one that can author feed management plans. So I went through all that. And if you ask me how I've put it to use so far in the last 6 to 8 months, zero. But kind of say that tongue in cheek, right? Like, let's add more letters to the credentials.
You got a lot of letters after that already. Yes.
Oh, it's ridiculous. Just trying to convince people that I'm not a complete moron.
Right. That's how I spend every day.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, no, it was interesting. Like you said, we were at that meeting a few weeks ago in Point, and it's always interesting to hear other people's perspectives on it. I feel like I've been drubbed to death with carbon stuff over the last few years, but I still learned something. And that's always my goal when I go to those types of meetings, is to at least take something new away and learning the process and stuff that they were talking about for those models was what I kind of picked up as new for me at that meeting. Was there anything that really stood out for you, John, at that?
Yeah, I got to choose my words carefully. So this is an area I've spent probably more and more of my time, to the point now I'm spending a quarter of my time on sustainability projects, endeavors, research, and or networking, or putting other projects and proposals together. And the reason that I've allocated that much of my time, and there's, you guys can speak to this, there's never enough time for you to take on your professional obligations, and we can't do it at the expense of our roles as fathers and husbands and family. But there's a lot of capital out there. The Fed and the USDA have earmarked north of $4 billion with a B, bravo, for climate smart commodity programs and projects. And in, going back to my time at the University of Wisconsin with you guys and in graduate school, just in my experience, if a researcher is awarded a $1 million grant with an M, Mary, that would be sort of career defining. And in the last couple of years, there have been $4,000 million allocated toward grant programs for climate initiatives under the Climate Smart Commodity umbrella through the USDA toward our agricultural producers and commodity producers. So that money is, it's been awarded to a number of different groups, 70 to 100 different groups, and then they are tasked with channeling that money through different projects and programs to influence practices and initiatives. And these practices are things that we advise our clients on at Tilth, and then myself and through Rock River Cows Agree, just different ways to improve agricultural production, but with sustainability in mind. So coming back to just the $4 billion and why I'm spending time is to try and bring what scientific integrity and help producers make effective decisions and be aware and hopefully capture some of the financial incentives out there that can somewhat diversify or add a little bit of diversification to their revenue each year. Because there's a lot of money out flowing around. That's just from the Fed. There are also commercial dollars out there from organizations that are interested in offsetting or reducing their carbon footprint by way of offsets or insets. And so this is in terms of business opportunities, financial opportunities for our agricultural producers, dairy producers in particular, we can't turn away from, hence why I'm spending some time and why it continues to come up as a topic.
Is it new on the feed side, John? Newer? On the agronomy side, we've been hearing about it, would you guys say, for five-ish years?
And
obviously things change over time, but that's been what's tricky is the who's running the program, how it's run, all that. The goals maybe have changed and what our aim is. But on the feed side, is it quite new or is it older?
The research is the body of research is 20 plus years old. However, the programs and incentives and drive to reduce, and here's the term, enteric methane emissions. I've said this 10,000 times, so it just rolls off my tongue now. But enteric methane emissions, this is the cow burps, the cow farts that you may have picked up in mainstream media. The programs and emphasis on reducing the methane emissions, that has certainly picked up. So there are a couple paths to monetization right now through different projects that I don't know are overly popular at this point, but there certainly will be more. There certainly will be more.
So the cow, that's the cow farts, right, Matt?
Yep.
Burps, yep. Both ends, really.
Exactly. Yes.
Are the dollars decent, John? I mean, it seems like I've been involved in some projects on the agronomy side, and it seems like the amount of money that these growers are getting for cover crops, no-till, those kinds of things, I'm spending all that time and my efforts just getting the records that all these companies want, the previous year's tillage, the previous year's fertilizer. And it's like, we're just spinning our wheels, I feel, in some of these.
Yeah, that's the unfortunate position I think we're still at the moment. The incentives, and speaking to a couple of dairies, or one in particular in Wisconsin that I've had some deeper discussions with that has some years worth of experience having been approached by different groups with projects and incentives. The incentives aren't great right now. I want to believe that they will increase, and that our producers, growers, and dairies will recognize a little bit greater financial incentives just with all the amount of money that I referenced before that's sitting out there. But no, Bill, you're right. They're still modest in my mind at best. Modest at best.
Yeah, no, and there's a lot of hands already in that cookie jar, and I think there's only going to be more moving forward when it comes to carbon credits. So,
well said. Yeah, well said.
But that's go ahead, John.
We just have to continue to look for opportunities that aren't a whole lot more work, but can dovetail into things that we are doing or practices we might be evaluating, and then potentially find another $10,000, $15,000 in revenue without a huge investment in time, Bill, like you said, where we have to go and secure and aggregate a whole bunch of records. That doesn't work.
Well, we could probably spend this whole episode talking carbon, but the reason we wanted to bring you in today, John, and talk with you is the feed side of things, and we're getting close to harvest season for some guys. Other guys are a little further out with the variable planting dates we've got out there. So I guess to start, what do you think some strategies are to feed this poor quality hay that we've pulled in? So first, a lot of guys first, especially second crop even, were high tonnage, low quality feed. And how do we make that work in a ration?
Nutritionists can make everything work, right? Like whatever you guys give us, we just take it and we don't complain at all. We just say, oh, we're happy to have this feed quality, whatever it is, and we'll just make magic out of it. This year is bringing some different opportunities or different challenges to the table. I didn't head a last week or up until last week. I didn't even look into the hay and haylage quality through Rock River Laboratories database. We've got this data visualization tool that's tied in with Rock River's data in the overall database. So we can look at crop quality trends, et cetera, with an interface, a Shiny app dashboard, if you will. And I should probably get that to you guys. If any listeners out there are interested in having access to that, there's a public version of this application where you can jump in and look at quality at any point on your own time at your own discretion. But when I used that data visualizer tool and I looked at the crop quality this year, largely alfalfa for the upper Midwest, it's ugly. It's ugly. We've fallen off in terms of forage quality. Just to reset, when I look at a feed analysis and the numbers that I look at, dairy cattle need protein and they need energy. On the energy side, dairy cattle can pull energy from fiber and starch and sugar. That's kind of really where the energy comes from in our feeds, is in carbohydrates primarily. And fiber is unique in that it in theory carries the same energy potential as starch or sugar. However, dairy cows can only unlock about half the calories in fiber. So I'm not looking to take you guys back to our animal science 101 class with Dave Combs our now retired professors at Wisconsin or wherever you went to school. But it's important to understand that fiber does contribute some energetic value, but it also contributes bulk to the feed. And so when I look at a feed test and when we project out energy value in feeds, really, fiber is a signal for us, much like we might look at and talk about maybe wheat as a signal for what corn silage anti-nutritional factors may be. So there's a carrot for us maybe to come back to in a little bit. And the fiber content's way up. So our fiber content's way up this year. And it's through no fault of our producers out there in terms of cutting schedules. We were behind the eight ball with Mother Nature trying to get our corn in the ground, trying to get our first cutting done and off the field, and then subsequently second cuttings and third cuttings. So by and large, we fell off in terms of fiber content, meaning we have more fiber in our feed this year. And so from a nutritional standpoint, more fiber means less calories. It also means less intake potential. So fiber is unique in that a dairy cow needs fiber. We need some functional fiber in the rumen, in the diet to keep the animal healthy. So in some cases, I've heard of feed being too rich or too hot, where we have super high fiber digestibility. And in my mind, I don't think we can ever have too high a fiber digestibility. But coming back to reality this year, that's certainly not going to be the case for virtually everybody. And nutritional strategies to feed this stuff, it's going to be first and foremost understanding what we have under plastic. And when I say under plastic, in the bags, in the bunkers, in the piles, if you're feeding on uprights, maybe a little bit more difficult to understand what we've got. But I and of course I say this with a grain of salt because I my primary responsibility is overseeing animal nutrition with a feed and forage and soil and plant tissue testing laboratory. So I'm not always going to tell you to test 10 times over, right? But in reality, we need to understand what we've got on farm under plastic. And then with that in mind, put our forages together, not just get into a new feed and then test it and say, all right, well, this is what we've got. But we've got probably, for most producers out there, three cuttings-ish done. For those in central or western Wisconsin, maybe two, because we were pushed so far back. But let's try and, or I'd like to see some analyses done through your reputable forage testing lab, maybe a couple feed samples at least, to get some bird's eye view of what our nutritional quality is, so we can understand what we're dealing with before we open up that big pile of feed or get into a bag where once it's open, then we got to go. And I think forward, if I can put a plug in for forward thinking producers out there and growers, some of the leading dairies that I'm working with are pretty aggressively sampling their feed as it's coming into the feed center, to the tune of even 25 to 75 feed tests over the duration of that harvest. So we know beyond the shadow of a doubt what our feed quality is. And then once we know that, we can strategically work through that feed in terms of putting together one, our silage with maybe a certain cutting, a haylage. But I want to see us have a better understanding of what's under plastic before we get into feeding it. Because coming back to, if we've got three cuttings of haylage, and I'll borrow this, I think it was Alan Wilder, or maybe it was Joe Lawrence, but one of the two, they're agronomists out east with Miner Institute and Cornell Pro Dairy. They're guys that I called, in addition to Todd, setting up for last week's webinars. They, one of the two stated, we need to redefine our definition of high quality forage this year. And just one, coming back to my point of understanding what we have under plastic, but then allocate that higher quality forage, even if it's average to below average relative to years past, earmark that higher quality forage in this year's crop or this year's inventory, and put that towards our higher producing cows. So there's quite a few things we can do as nutritionists. We can dilute or reduce the amount of haylage we're feeding. Just if we have too much fiber, all right, we'll maybe back off the hay or haylage we're feeding. Right now, thankfully, commodity prices are, and this isn't great for your grain farmers out there, but corn's not overly expensive. And then that tends to put some bearish pressure on our other commodities, such as corn gluten feed and soy hulls, other feeds that we can bring in from an energy standpoint. So we can offset the less than ideal fiber content and forage quality in our haylage by bringing in some soy hulls, bringing in some corn gluten feed. So those are strategies that we're taking advantage of right now. We're just finding how much haylage we can feed. Maybe in years past, it's been 10 pounds per cow per day. Maybe it's down to 6 or 8 pounds per cow per day, just because the quality is less. There's quite a bit more fiber, and we tend to feed based on fiber restrictions or fiber amounts. But then we would bring in, say, 2 to 4 pounds of soy hulls or corn gluten feed, or perhaps even distiller's grains to offset that quality.
That's good to have a bunch of options there, because it always feel bad as an agronomist when we give the nutritionist not great feed. And like you said, this year it wasn't a management thing. It wasn't a problem. It was just Mother Nature. But I do agree that nutritionists have become magicians with that, that they used to, 10 years ago, they'd yell at us, get better feed. What are you doing? Now it's usually the comment of like, oh yeah, we'll figure it out. We'll manage through it. Mm-hmm. We'll find ways. And like what you said too, say guys, even with bags this year, probably going to be at an advantage where you could feed out of multiple or do, just be an interesting year with
the mix and match.
Yes. Yeah.
If we know what we've got, right. So for our guys that are feeding out of bags this year, if you haven't sampled it going in, and you got to be careful with this, but I'd suggest getting a hay probe and drilling into your bags, maybe 2-3 spots, and make sure you tape it up well, really seal it up. You don't want that oxygen getting in. You don't want to get moldy. But and do an assessment of your inventory in terms of quality. And yeah, the guys out there with bags, if we can feed a couple of them, you have a big advantage this year. Big advantage.
So I gather from what you said about quality is that RFE and RFQ aren't the same thing. I know they're not, but a lot of agronomists seem to think that's kind of the same thing. So what do you see as, or can you explain that, I guess, a little bit more?
So if you know that they're not, then can I hire you as a nutritionist as well? I don't know if the DILF team would be overly happy with that, but I'd love to bring you on board as a budding nutritionist as well. Relative feed value and relative forage quality, these two terms These acronyms have been around for decades at this point. The relative feed value comes back to that point I made earlier with regard to what defines forage quality. Relative feed value is defined by, and you know, for those of you listening out there, you could even write this down if you want to look at the numbers on your forage report that influence the RFV, relative feed value. It's ADF, acid detergent fiber, and neutral detergent fiber. That's it. So at the feed lab, we have a couple of different measures we use to determine fiber content in feed. The neutral detergent fiber, just to kind of help you rationalize what the feed lab does, is we'll take a feed sample and we'll dry it and grind it. And then we put it through something that's very similar to when you put your clothes in a laundry machine and you put some detergent in the laundry machine and you wash away all the dirt, all the, you know, like my daughter yesterday, she was painting with watercolors and riding her bike, and my wife was lamenting her for getting her brand new school clothes destroyed while we put her shirts and pants in the laundry machine with some laundry soap, Tide or Costco or whatever. And then that detergent washes away everything that's not clothing. We rinse them, we dry them, and we end up with our clothing. That's what we do at the feed lab. And we use a neutral detergent that is essentially laundry soap to do that. So what we just wash away everything that's not fiber, and then we're left with that neutral detergent fiber. And then there's another reagent that's got a little bit of an acidic nature to it. It washes away a little bit more of the fiber complex. Those two numbers, ADF and NDF, are what define your relative feed value. I can go into more detail for those interested parties out there. Just reach out to me after the fact. But to differentiate relative feed value from relative forage quality is another number that is on the same scale, sliding scale of the relative feed value. So relative feed value, the distribution, we tend to average, you know, this year we're averaging probably 125 relative feed value based on those higher fiber contents. And that would correspond to probably 45 to 50% total fiber, just to put some numbers out there. Relative forage quality is intended to be on the same scale, averaging probably around 125 to 150 long-term, but the range as low as 75, and then the high end might be 225, 250, even 300. It's a normal distribution, but the numbers that define relative forage quality are very different. The fiber amount, the neutral detergent fiber, is one component of that relative forage quality number. However, protein and ash, which are two important measures on your forage report, which we can influence through agronomic practices and harvest practices, and then fiber digestibility, which we can influence by cutting time. Certainly the growing environment, our crop health have something to do with that. Fiber digestibility comes into the relative forage quality. So on average, I would say looking at a decade worth of data, those two numbers would be one and the same. However, each year they will likely be different corresponding to the growing environment that we're harvesting our crop in, because we see those fiber digestibility numbers and those total fiber numbers move up and down just with the year. So they're similar numbers in that they're on the same distribution, but totally different inputs in terms of the numbers that go into those.
Are you really seeing 120 as the average? You know, what's a normal average that you see, and what is it this year? How far off the target do you think we actually hit?
Yeah, we're a good 25 off this year. I'm actually going to pull open that Rock River Nutrition History app right now, and I'll just kind of visualize it so I can make sure to bring utmost accuracy and accountability on the Tilt Talk podcast today. But we're a good 20 to 25 points off this year, if I recall what I was looking at last
Bill,
week.
If we remember back doing we did scissor clips, you know, throughout Allegheny County, through some of the counties, and track those, and there was, you know, weeks that went, we were going to stop, and, you know, where you really stop when they cut, basically, but we figured they'd cut, and it was mostly 3 weeks longer that we kept doing them, and it was even hard to get accurate samples because it was lodged, and you'd lift up that first crop alfalfa, and it was 30 inches tall, and the bottom 15 inches had no leaves on them, and the top 15 inches were full of leaves, so it just... It was a very, you know, we know it was high tons, but thinking back to what that looked like, it's really was the loss of leaves that made that. Obviously, what really fooled me is the amount of flowers out there, John. It was going to flower, but it wasn't like...
No, it didn't rapidly flower. No, like
you would expect these fields to just be purple, and in general, they weren't. So that was unique to it, too.
Yeah, I was hearing that far and wide that the maturity didn't advance like we might have expected. And I don't exactly know why that was, if it was cloud cover, just the rainfall, these crops, the alfalfa physiology changed, the growth and development changed. I don't know.
We were lucky in that way, because that could have been both ways, where you have this, you know, almost like cordwood out there. And it was, the stem was thick, but it wasn't that, like, where it was so mature that you're way past the point.
What's funny to me is, thinking back to all the times I've done scissor clips, and there's always a farm that, like, almost wants that. And I think it's a testament, John, to what you were saying before about having different strategies, what nutritionists can do with what you give them, as long as you know what you have.
Well, and typically for these scissor clips, we pick farms that cut late. You don't want to pick the farm that cuts first, because you'll have less data points. So you tend to pick farms that cut later in general, so you have more data points. So you're right, there is certain farms that are...
But yeah, this is not the only year I've walked across hay fields without ever touching the ground. And
yes, where it's
and there have been years, yeah, where that's, you know, what the farm wants. Like, yeah, it's not any good until it's lodged. And it's like, oh, okay.
Well, I want to compliment you guys and put a plug in for your team's, I would say, leadership efforts in doing those scissor clips and arming the producers and growers that you support with more and better information to help them make decisions. There's a lot of growers out there that are still not doing peak sticks or scissor clipping heading into their cuttings. I mean, first crop, we can do okay with a stick and looking at GDDs, but second, third, fourth, or if we get a fifth cutting, we need that scissor clip insight to go along with your agronomist assessment of where that crop is at, what our disease pressure is looking like, et cetera, how our crown health and stand counts are doing. So good on you guys for doing that. Keep it up.
Yes, keep testament it up. And in terms to the counties.
Year over year,
counties keep doing
feed value.
Yeah, go ahead, John. I just want to plug the counties as well for help. You know, a lot of the Kevin Jarek throughout a game, he's done a lot to help us with still working through that program, because I know the state had talked about this continuing the scissor clip thing, and hopefully we can keep showing that there's value to that whole program. And when you do it on a county basis and you kind of have that big picture.
Absolutely. I appreciate you bringing that point up. And Liz Gartman as well, a little bit to the south, has done some outstanding work. So, I mean, Tilt Talk podcast, excellent source of relevant information in the moment. The Liz Gartman and the Crop Connect webinars are another great source of information to network with their efforts. So appreciate you making that point. Certainly the extension teams in Eastern Wisconsin are outstanding, helping us project out that fiber content. So now to dovetail that back to what I'm seeing year over year, I was speculating maybe 20, 25 points of relative feed value, might be slightly less than that we're off this year, but our fiber content looks to be up over last year. And there's going to be 2 points to this that I think are relevant to our discussion today. I mean, one is the average, but then also distribution. So we'll talk a little bit more about that. The 2024 crop relative to 23, we look to be about 2 to 3 units increase in average in fiber content. So that if we take that number times 5, that's generally the impact that fiber content has upon relative feed value, unfortunately, in the opposite direction. So if we're 3 units up in NDF content, we're going to be 15 units down in relative feed value. So that would be about 15 units year over year that we're down. Another and probably more important point, though, and this is going to be relevant to our corn crop, the spread to, and for those of you just listening in, you can't see me talking with my hands, but just picture me making like a flipper motion with my hands as I'm trying to visualize a wider spread to the data. A normal bell curve, I think most people understand what a bell curve looks like. Our Liberty Bell, for example, that's what a data distribution looks like, where the average is in the middle and then it kind of dovetails down and then you've got the tails. The distribution to the crop quality this year, I'm not even going to bother showing you guys my screen for those of you looking, visualizing some of what we're talking about today. It looks like a pancake. We've got 25 ish, you know, a quarter of our fields and samples out there that are probably like 100 to 125 relative feed value. So it's a pancake in distribution. And again, this is no fault of any of our growers out there. I mean, we do really well today in the upper Midwest and Wisconsin. We are sought after in terms of providing knowledge and insights to producers and dairy producers and crop farmers throughout the world. But oof, did Mother Nature throw us for a loop this year in terms of just the moisture and our ability to get out to fields and cut and then subsequently get that stuff merged and taken off.
And that pancake makes sense. So we saw a few guys were able to get in kind of that early.
They hit a window, right?
It was a mid-May. Yeah.
They hit the, they were like, we're not planting corn. Screw it. We're going to make hay. They got the hay off.
And if you hit that window, you kept hitting it for second and third. And now a lot of those guys lapped other guys. So they, some of them are taking a fourth crop while everybody was taking third crop.
Right.
So that's like, yeah, the pancake crop makes a lot of sense.
I can put some numbers to that. I can look at a different table and I'll spare you guys the statistical details. But as I look at this, the normal spread where there would be, let's just say 70% of the samples would fall within a 8 to 10 point window of fiber content. So 70% of our samples would range the last few years between, you know, say 36 and 45. This year, that number that's stretched out to, or even 38 to 45. This year, that low end is stretched down to 36, 37. Bill, I think for some of the guys that hit that earlier window that you're talking about, so 37% fiber, that's super high quality, high relative feed value. Our high end has increased 10% up to 50% fiber. So we've added probably 2 to 5 units in terms of just the distribution of our fiber this year. And again, back to my point earlier, test your feed, know what we've got. Holy buckets, do we have a spread in quality out there, at least with the samples at Rock River Laboratory seeing.
And last I checked, John, cows like the same thing, right? They like exactly the same feed. You know, we're a little different. We like some variety. We like our cheeseburgers and our pizza, but a cow and a nutritionist likes predictability, and I think that's going to be a struggle this year. Even we're going to get into corn silage, I'm sure, in a minute, and that's going to give us a whole nother unpredictability, and that's what we don't want is not knowing what the heck we got. So you're right. Test.
We've got 2 nutritionists on the call today. So Todd, you're the odd man out so far on the discussion on the podcast.
When you were talking earlier about taking, you know, some of the animal science stuff, Bill would have a similar past than I was. Strict agronomy, but
yep,
Bill,
I did. Bill start did dairy science,
dairy stuff to start. So he's
I did work in a nutrition lab at UW for 3 years, John. So
awesome.
I do. It's been a while, but it was there.
Picked up a couple things though.
You got some of that foundation, much like my foundation. Took a few classes in agronomy, but haven't practiced it in 20 years, so I have no idea what I'm talking about.
I did grind cow pies for several
grinding
days.
Grinding cow pies, I like that.
Yep.
Yeah, and that's not a dust-free endeavor. So
oh God.
We'll leave it there.
Yeah.
All right,
we'll leave it there,
Bill. That's.
But yeah, cows like consistency, and unfortunately this year, I mean, we can put together all sorts of different diets. Diets in California look dramatically different than the upper Midwest, and diets in Texas look completely different. We can feed cows a range of different ingredients. I mean, all sorts of different things that no other animals on this planet can turn into very valuable and nutritious milk and butter and animal protein. But we have to know what it is, and then we have to work to provide those cows consistency and not put different feeds or different quality in front of them day in or week in, week out.
Yeah, I think Bill made a good attempt at a transition there. So let's talk corn. So we know what we've got for hay, hopefully, if we've tested. Now we're looking down the barrel of corn silage coming up here. And anywhere from, you know, a couple weeks to a month or more, depending on planting date, is where we're probably sitting with a lot of guys. So for dry downs this year, you know, it's something that we as a company do a lot of. I couldn't even guess at how many we do a year.
More than 1,000.
But what is your take on corn silage dry downs? You know, is it the 4 stalks? Are we better off doing test loads? Are we better off sampling individual parts of a field? Like what's your feeling on what would give us the best bang for our buck this year?
Well, for the tilthies out there, continue to work closely with your tilth agronomist. If you're not a tilthy, get aggressive this year. Buddy up with your agronomist and use your planting date and maybe some GDD tools out there. Or if you took note of when your crop was tasseling, use that like a hand grenade in terms of when you might consider chopping corn. But I was talking with another grower yesterday. If we knew our corn tasseled, let's just say 4th of July, add 45 days to that. Generally, we've got about 45 days after tasseling to when our corn is in the hand grenade window of being ready to chop. And I would say subtract maybe 7 to 10 days from that, and then be walking your fields, starting to look at kernel maturity, and consider taking some samples, or doing some sampling and doing some moisture checks. So Matt, coming back to your question in terms of, all right, how do we start assessing moisture? I would say on a normal year, and I don't even know what normal is anymore. The last few years, we've certainly been thrown for a loop, and some really, really bright guy who I really look up to and I hope to be as good as someday said that we seem to be one-upping ourselves each of the last few years. That guy, I think, was by the name of Todd, so we'll leave it at that. But we seem to be one-upping ourselves. So on a normal year, I'd say go out and certainly get away from the headlands and get at least 3 subsamples from a field that you chose to check. And you work with your agronomist, or maybe look at your crop plan in terms of acres that are going to go for silage, and try and sample at least 10% of your acres, ideally maybe a third, and get at least 3 subsamples from each field to run through a chipper or get some idea of what the moisture content might be in terms of, you know, what a reasonable approach would be within a field in terms of stalks. Not 1 or 2 stalks. I mean, I would say 4 to 6 would be reasonable in an area that looks representative. Coming back to the pancake distribution of quality this year in alfalfa, I'm expecting the same thing on corn. So we can dive into that a little bit more just in terms of how to approach this year. I think we need to do more in terms of walking our fields, doing more in terms of moisture checks, and whether that's getting 4 to 6 stalks out of 3 different locations within a field, running those through the chipper and checking moisture, or even running some test loads where we run our chopper out there and maybe go, if we got a Kemper head, go perpendicular into the field so that we can get a cross section of say 30 to 60 rows after we get into the field to get some idea. I mean, I really like the idea of running test loads, but I don't know how many guys are going to be overly excited about driving their machine into a field and, cutting some slices like a loaf of bread that doesn't always look the best either if you're driving through the roadside. So
we just talk about test loads at this time of year, like, oh yeah, I didn't have this. And then when it comes to actually doing it, like you say, John, and I get it why you don't, but this year they are going to be so key. The problem is once that chopper starts, it's hard to stop it. So it feels like the test load mentality's got to be, you know, this is just the preseason. We're just checking it.
Yep.
This isn't the regular season.
We need just
season
the chopper yet. Driver. We don't need the whole crew.
Yes. And, you know, get sort of that ease into it. I know people, you know, like soft launches?
Soft opening.
Opening, that's where it's soft opening. It's like today is the soft opening day. The hard opening day will be determined by that. But that is one struggle is when you start, it's hard to stop. And then you sort of start justifying that moisture. Like, well, it's at, you know, it's 30% dry matter, so we're close, and I don't want to go away. The hardest one is maybe 32% dry matter when it's right at sort of 68% moisture, and you're kind of. But it's like, no, if it's at your goal, you start. If it's not, you stop. So yeah, whereas getting a chipper shredder out, they don't. You know, that's pretty easy to start and stop with that scenario. So.
Right. And do more of that chipper shredder approach this year. Again, Matt, to your question, at least 4, but up to 6 stalks. If we get any more than 6 stalks, then that's pretty hard to manage through that chipper shredder. But we can make up for that by doing more subsamples in a field. So in normal years, I'd say get 3 subsamples in a field. Maybe this year we do 5, just given the heterogeneity and the widespread to our maturity within a field that I've heard from you guys. I mean, tell me what you're seeing, though, in terms of maturity within a field, maturity between fields relative to the expected crop development and maturation with the corn relative maturity or the seed we put in the ground?
I would say my early stuff is more consistent than my late planted
Correct.
Stuff.
That'll help us a tremendous amount this year is that the first stuff we're going to chop is more consistent. So it'll be a lot easier to pull that trigger than the chopper already started for those second windows. And they're very distinct this year, John, where it's sort of some May timings. You know, and then there's like a mid-June timing, and then there's an early July timing. So
there's corn that's in the ground as late as July?
There is. And it varies a lot by township, probably would be the word, you know, even by – but by certain townships were really affected. And obviously they did. They were able to get some of that early in, some of that mid, and then that real late, you know, has a different – some of it maybe they took a triticale off. and then put corn in. And to be honest, looking at it, it's doing okay, which is good. Mm-hmm. But there is this sort of unique windows that way. And then within the fields, though, it is definitely, there's ups and downs and
but you're all right. kinds of things. But you're right, Matt. The early planted stuff is pretty even. It's the later planted stuff that they kind of mudded in because it was getting late and they just wanted something in the ground. And it's like, okay, we better do it. That stuff's pretty uneven.
If I had a dime for every time I heard the calendar says go this year.
So as I'm hearing you guys describe some of the impact on the consistency or lack thereof within a field or between fields, then I start to think about from a nutritionist perspective or even a harvest and a crop management perspective. What I'm hearing from you guys, are we going to be able to just go at it in one swing in terms of making silage? No. I'm seeing heads shaking no. So no. We're probably going to have, and this is what some of the agronomists out in New York were talking about, because they had some of this last year too, is that we're probably going to have a couple of windows. Then with that in mind, I don't want to see guys try and mash this all together. And in some dairies, some feed centers, that's we've got a certain feed pad where silage goes and we're just going to do what we can. But if we can think about in any way, shape, or form, or design some strategy to separate or differentiate that early planted silage from that mid to later planted silage, that affords me as a nutritionist so many more options. And coming back to Bill's point earlier, cows crave consistency. And so corn silage has a lot more, I would say, variation than what we know about. It's certainly a more consistent crop than our different haylage cuttings, but as I've worked with some dairies and some of larger producers that you guys work with as well, we test our silage, say, 2 to 3 times a week, and there's a lot more going on in normal silage. And this year, with what you guys have just described and what we know, let's segregate and separate that early stuff from that later stuff. And then we can, from a nutritionist and in our feeding program and plan, we can manage that very differently and very well, I think.
Yeah, you just kind of jumped into our next question, which was bunker strategies for multiple cuttings and how to kind of manage that. So I think it's good to have that mindset of that it has happened before. Like you mentioned, New York, they were looking at it last year. So we're not the pioneers on this one for good measure, and that's good.
John, at the Twilight meeting at Outagamie County Forage Council last week, Kevin Jerk volunteered me to give a talk on some of these things. I just shared a...
Which then you proceeded to roast.
Oh, I roasted him. I had to roast him. He's
for a good early portion of the...
Well, we go way back, so yeah, he knew...
It was like the Tom Brady roast a little bit, but it was maybe a little toned down.
He was my egg teacher when I was a senior in high school, so I kind of had.
Oh, he's a good guy.
Yeah, I just had to get him, so he knew it was coming. I actually just shared our screen here, John. I looked back at a lot of our planting dates. Todd, you had talked about these different windows, and it seemed like that May, at least in our neck of the woods, May 5th to 8th was a window. Around the 18th was another window. And then end of May and then mid-June were kind of like our windows. So I think you're right. We're not going to be able to just start and finish. We're going to have to stop at some point because some of this stuff isn't going to catch up.
It's catching up more than we thought it would, but it's still not enough, like you say, for managing the bunker properly and doing that. And then the true part about if you can segregate it, I think the more options, the better. And again, that's looking at piles right now and trying to plan out how much tonnage is going to be on that tile. Because the other tricky part is a lot of them are maybe like, you guys might agree, like a third of that was in the, some of it's half and half acres wise. Mm-hmm. But as far as tonnage goes, that first batch is going to out-ton it. You know, most of that first batch is say around 20 to 25 ton. And then the second batch is more like 15 to 20 ton. So I think you're actually going to have about the same amount of tonnage, and it'll depend on your farm. So having that pre-planned and knowing that going in, I think it's going to help a lot rather than you get into it and then you can't move a pile once it's started. It's very correct. Difficult. It's very difficult to make piles in general, let alone talk about how to manage them without having a plan.
At the very least, if we've got, say, some mid-June planted and there's going to be a clear separation in a couple of weeks between planting dates, I hate feeding out of bags. I hate making bags. I hate bag and feed in general. However, as we talked about earlier, with bags, we have maybe more options in terms of strategically managing that feed. So if we have, say, a third to a quarter of our acres or silage that are just at a window that is a week or two separated from everything else, give some thought to just putting that elsewhere, potentially bagging that silage or putting it off on a different pile, because I just don't want to see, I don't want to see us go at it in one swoop where we get two thirds of our corn that's in the right window, but then we got a third or a quarter of our corn that's immature. And well, we've got the pile open, we're going, we're not going to stop. And then all of a sudden we've got a section of the pile on top or at the back end that's just juicing and running. We gave up a bunch of starch, and we want to hang on and let that corn put down as much starch as we can and get into that moisture window. I mean, coming back to go, no go, it's going to continue to be moisture. In years past, we talked about kernel maturity in addition to moisture, and we certainly have healthier corn thanks to your guys. And our seed genetics is probably number one or close to it, and then crop protection strategy. So we've had healthier corn. Our kernels have matured a little bit, maybe more than they have historically in years prior. But this year, we're going to take what we get, but we do have an opportunity to target an appropriate moisture for fermentation, and we can manage that. So don't lose sight of that. I don't want to see corn that's in the pile, provided that we don't have disease come in, but I don't want to see 70, even 68% moisture corn the last few years has run like heck and leaches like heck. And so that we can let that corn go a little bit longer and segregate it. That's something we need to be talking about right now.
In a year or two where we're going to need tons, you know, that they're out there, but we're still going to need them. It does seem that waiting just that little bit, if you can wait to, you know, over 35% dry matter versus under, we're seeing a gain in easily a ton or two that could help us a lot this year. So yeah, I agree with what you're saying, John, on that.
Well,
so,
and this latest planted corn, we're going to struggle to get any starch out of, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So
we don't know yet.
We got to get what we can early.
You need heavy laden starch on that early first crop silage. First crop corn silage.
Yeah. We'll have first, second, maybe even third crop silage this year.
Hey, that is a real thing out there for growers down in Florida, California, right. Or New Mexico, Arizona. We can double crop silage.
So something we've been talking about, John, more recently is we're starting to see tar spot kind of emerge in some of these fields. And generally, when it comes in this late, you know, silage is getting close with the early planted stuff, but it's the later planted silage potentially could get more of this tar spot in it. Have you seen anything through the years? What does tar spot do to feed quality? How can that affect us?
Feed quality is defined by a couple of things. One is the energy potential, like we were describing before. Fiber content, starch, those really dictate the energetic value in silage. Feed quality can also be defined by anti-nutritional factors in feed. So, I mean, just let's analogize to these 1,000-plus horsepower self-propelled harvesters out there. They've got all sorts of potential. So say we have a crop standing in the field that's going to be 200-ish bushel or 180 bushel corn, you know, reasonable stature. That's probably going to be 32, 35% starch, decent energy potential. Potential is the key word. Now, coming back to our 1,000-horsepower machine, if we've got some water in our diesel, all of a sudden that machine's not going to be operating. It's not going to be firing as well. So we got all the potential in the world, but we've got water in our diesel. The fuel is dirty and we aren't realizing that potential. Tar spot and moving into some other disease, ear stalk rots that can produce good toxins, or if we get some other deterioration that happens, those act like water and diesel in terms of just disrupting rumen potential and metabolism. So tar spot itself is not a huge concern in terms of mycotoxin production. Mycotoxins is a buzzword with dairies and nutritionists. Those are very toxic compounds in feed that we've got quite a bit of research in and around. But what tar spot unfortunately does is it opens the door toward, I would say, more rapid dry downs, that plant dying off, maybe the harvest window shortening relative to what it might have been if it not come in. So tar spot can kick off a cascade of other issues where we may not have as well fermenting corn. Maybe we have some less desirable feed quality because it got more mature. The plant died off at a different rate than we were expecting with our harvest management plan. So tar spot itself isn't the concern, but tar spot then kicks off a cascade and spiral of other anti-nutritional concerns that might come about during fermentation, or perhaps maybe some other diseases come in on the heels of that. Tell me what you guys have seen historically with tar spot, or what you might be speculating this year with tar spot, or what other concerns might go along with it.
I think my concern is just plant moisture.
Right.
Right. Yeah, just
that's just it.
It's rapid dry down.
Yeah. Where it just gets away from us and we lose moisture and we can't catch up to it.
And usually we do see a tonnage loss, but not if it comes on late, not as much as what the moisture problem is. And from a quality standpoint too, we are seeing, you know, wheat this year was very high in vomitoxin in general. So that is one concern we have is, and that's even guys that sprayed fungicide and it was still high in vomitoxin. So that's somewhat of a proxy to maybe show us that this corn silage crop potentially would have, you know, more chances for other toxins that are a problem, you know, and diseases. So something to be watching in your fields. It's going to be different for each grower, very different, because we're seeing that way that especially is by certain areas are getting affected by tar spot more. You know, it's in a lot of the Wisconsin counties, but there's certain areas within that county that maybe has more of it. And then you go to the next township and you don't see much at all. So even within growers, I got a few fields where, yeah, you got maybe one or two fields that have it, but the rest of them are fine. So I think in general, we're not seeing, luckily so far, we're not seeing where it's going to blindside us or really affect us, but you might have to manage around it depending where you're located.
Yeah, the growing environment, I appreciate you coming back to wheat, because that was something I had a question from another one of my clients. I take a look at what vomitoxin in wheat is looking like this year. And Todd, you hit the nail on the head. I mean, the vomitoxin levels in wheat through the lab are up notably. I mean, they're concern levels to above concern levels in terms of vomitoxin in that wheat grain. So I am heightened awareness with regard to anti-nutritional factors. Mycotoxins showing up in our silage. Thankfully, we've had a little bit drier of a spell over the last few days to out into the next week, but that concern is out there. If I can speak to growers in the Northeast, they had these conditions last year, which we didn't experience because we were drier and our plant disease triangle, I mean, that growing environment is so very important. We didn't have a conducive environment last year. This year, we certainly do. So I know you guys are on top of it with your growers, with your producers, and not only be looking at maturity and watching moistures this year as we head into our harvest windows, but also be looking for tar spot or other diseases that, to Bill's point earlier, that's the big concern with tar spot, just that moisture in that corn dropping like it's falling off a cliff, and then we can't get ahead of it. If we find ourselves in that undesirable position, yet another reason to segregate that corn. Do not put that on the larger mass. If you got a larger pile that you're trying to make, either put it off to the back or put it off to the side or do something different with it. Don't let it just sit on top of and be mixed in with all your other corn.
John, I think it was one of your Hordes articles, somewhere like that, you had said to try to, and just tell me if I'm explaining this right, you were going to try to use up more of the we know the 2023 crop's very good quality. And so try to extend that as well, similar to what you talked about with alfalfa earlier, but with corn silage, try to blend in some of last year's good quality with this year's potentially poor quality. Can you maybe explain that a little better than what I
Yeah, so I haven't had any nutritionists shoot me or put out any death threats yet, so that's good. So maybe I can stay on this point. Typically, we don't want to be feeding two silages at any one point in time. Now, that is something we can do with haylage crops, maybe a little bit easier if just with our massive feed being a little bit smaller. If we're feeding out of bags, we can certainly do that. However, I was talking with, and this idea was, you know, not my own. I am largely the product of brilliant ideas of those I interact with, you guys, yourselves included. But I was talking to a dairy in Utah that was describing some of the issues that they've experienced in feeding corn grown in different circles. They irrigate everything, but their corn grown under different circles, it ends up being very different in nutritional quality. So they strategically feed out of a bag and their silage pile at the same time, just to lessen the impact of changes in any one of those feed sources. And so coming back to this wide pancake-like spread that we expect to be in quality and possibly even moisture in our silage this year, and maybe it's a little bit less digestible silage in terms of fiber digestibility. That is one thing that, Todd, we've talked about. Maybe there's going to be a little bit more lignin in this year's crop, just given the heavier rainfall we had earlier in the year. But we can offset that by feeding our 24 silage alongside a higher quality feed. And you know, our 23 silage, thankfully, has been excellent quality for a lot of our growers and dairies out there. And so we have proposed the concept of stretching out our 23 silage maybe a little bit longer and trying to feed that alongside 24 silage to stem the blow of what might be associated with feeding full 24 silage full tilt. So you know, how that might look is if we have say 3 months carryover, let's just pick a number out of thin air, and a lot of our dairies have carryover now, but if we would be feeding our 23 silage full tilt and we would expect to run out in December, conceivably or possibly we could maybe let our 24 silage ferment a month and then open that up and maybe feed 1/3 24 silage, 2/3 23 silage, and then all of a sudden have inventory of 23 silage. And this, we'd be doing this through the cold period of the year as well, which would help in terms of aerobic stability. So we wouldn't necessarily have the feed bunk concerns like we would if we were trying to feed two silages in the summer months. But if we could stretch our 23 silage, say another month or two out into January or February, I think that's going to be a good thing. I think that's going to lessen the impact our 24 silage in terms of average nutritional quality or potential swings in nutritional quality as we feed through it due to the factors we were talking about before with planting date and some other things. I think that strategy at least warrants discussion. It's not going to make sense for everybody, but I think that strategy makes sense to be talking about.
Yeah, I think that is one thing we've felt this whole season is that inventory wise guys have some capacity there and that lends that ability, where in other years like this where we've been extremely wet and had late planting, we haven't had necessarily the inventory to back fill next year's feed with some of our leftovers. So
I understand it's a nightmare from a feeding program standpoint. I mean, who wants to be feeding yet another source of silage? I've fed my share of days in the past, and to think about feeding out of two silages to go along with all of our other ingredients, I mean, I know there are guys that are going to be coming for me, but in terms of just providing that more consistent plane of nutrition or mitigating some of the swings in nutritional quality and nutrient supply and delivery in the diet, that can be a strategy that can smooth things out, if you will.
John, jumping gears a little bit, there are some acres around here because of the soil type we didn't get planted to corn and are pretty much our only option. The cocktail thing guys really don't like, so basically just went to sorghum. And what's your strategy as a nutritionist? The multiple cut, the one cut, is it really just kind of boils down to, do I want dairy quality? Do I want heifers? What am I after with my sorghum? Any thoughts on that? Because I know there's a few acres planted out there.
Are we planting male sterile sorghum or some brown midrub?
Mostly brown varieties. Midrub, yeah.
Okay. So then we can get some excellent feed quality that I think would rival some of our silage quality this year out of that brown midrub sorghum. In terms of if all things go well and we've got moisture and fertility to grow this out at, I can't remember how many weeks it would take, say it's 6 weeks, but at kind of a 4-foot height window to knock that down, swath it, and then put it up. And if it comes back and we could take a second cutting on that, we can get dairy quality feed out of that. I appreciate you, Bill, talking about what do we want to do with it? What's our strategy? Do we need some fiber for our young stock, or maybe we have, and coming back to understanding what our inventory and quality is with our haylage this year, maybe we actually want to be a little bit more aggressive with our fall harvest management, because if we did not get that rocket fuel or even average haylage quality that we were looking for earlier in the year, we do still have an opportunity to make some of that up with some crops that we might take off later this year. So we could maybe cut that sorghum at 3 foot to maybe let it still go to 4, but we can end up with some pretty good quality there. But I don't have a, this is how you have to do it. It's going to be dependent upon what our situation is and what our feed inventory is. If we need the tons, let it go, take a cut, and then rip it up or spray it off. But if we don't have the quality, which in our haylage, which a lot of our growers and producers out there don't necessarily have this year, I would say let's be pretty aggressive with that, or even consider putting some fall forage in the ground and aggressively managing that, cutting that pretty early to get some higher digestible feed.
If we wanted to look at a number, okay, we want dairy quality forage out of this sorghum, and we go take a scissor clip, we get that back. What's that number that we should think about to cut if we want good quality?
If it's 50% fiber or less in brown midriba, we're going to be able to feed that to dairy cattle. If we can get it 45% fiber with higher sugar levels and decent protein, that's going to be really really high quality sorghum, 45% NDF. So look at that NDF number in your scissor clippings. And the closer we can get that to 40, I don't think we'll ever get it to 40, but if we can keep it 45 to 50 in sorghum, that's going to feed pretty well with what I expect to be a pretty high sugar content and very good fiber digestibility at that maturity.
Perfect. Thank you.
All right. Well, we've enjoyed talking with you, John. We got one more thing to hit on before we wrap things up here, and that is last year we asked you a question and we put forth our suggestions for the name of the corn crop, and you and Corey Geiger did it the year before. So we had Tricky Beast in 2022. Last year we talked Raging Bull, which I know that whoever came up with that probably pretty smart guy. I don't know. But
a lot of brilliance here.
But this year, 2024, you know, we're running a lot of the same, you know, for different reasons. We're kind of in a similar boat to last year where planting dates and everything else didn't get through. Unfortunately, we've got a higher disease potential, like we talked. But so, Todd, you want to go first with your suggestions?
I'll start with my suggestions for John. So I always get excited about this of naming the crop every year. I don't know. John, you started it, so thank you for this idea, I guess, because it, and I think in the name we try to both talk about the agronomic and quality components both to it and put a label on it, and it can vary. But for this year, I've actually got two of them to suggest to you, John, for your judging. But the first one is fair fodder. So fair meaning it's okay out there, not good, not bad, especially on a whole. But you know, there's some really good stuff. And from a quality part, I think it's going to be pretty fair as well. Then the word fodder I like because it just describes to me, and maybe in the nutritional standpoint, when you use the word fodder, to me, fodder is just feed. Like, to me, this stuff it's just going to be feed. It's a jag. It's just another guy. It's not anything special. I don't think it's going to be the worst stuff you ever had. It's just sort of pretty average. And that my other name for it this year is okay crap. And okay meaning, again, we're going to be okay, but crap. This year was crap. It's just a frustrating year in a lot of ways. And I think that those are my two names for your consideration, John, in what I'm seeing in this crop, both in quality and agronomics.
I love it. So the first two horses out of the gate, they're pretty strong. All right, let's see what the rest of them are.
All right, Bill, what do you got?
All right, mine is roller coaster. Kind of sound of the same.
Erroneous. I think you're trying to rip off mine from last year.
I'm more generic than you. Went right to the name of a roller coaster, man.
It's true. Like, it's true.
It just for me, it's been a roller coaster of a year, ups and downs. The crop is uneven. You know, corn crops. We don't have at least in our neck of the woods, a lot of fields that are just the same from one end to the other. The hay crop's been a roller coaster. Some feed's really good, like we talked. Some feed's really bad. You know, we've made ruts in our fields, so now we got that to deal with. It's just been, the ups and downs this year have been really significant.
It reminds me when you go on a roller coaster, you got to wait usually at least 30 minutes in a line. You know, and there's that. It just feels like this year we were waiting to plant
30 days to plant.
Yeah, yeah.
And at it least was just sometimes like this, you vomit.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
We've done that too this year.
Yeah. I'm with you.
All right. And then last mine, I've got two as well. So my first is in honor of the Olympics, contested bronze. So we know it's, like Todd said, it's not the gold medal crop, probably not even silver medal crop. We're hoping for bronze, but
it's going to be contested.
There's some issues out there.
Judge's decision.
Yep. We're looking to the Russian judge, I guess, maybe this year to be a little bit more positive. And my other one was last-minute substitution. Initially, I had never-ending story because it feels like this is the season that never ended. I feel like I'm doing the same. It's like deja vu when you're going through and scouting tasseling corn and then knee-high corn in the same day. But I switched up to whiplash, and that kind of it's the feeling I get when I walk these fields because I'm looking up, and then I'm down, and I'm up. And I feel like the chopper, too, is going to go through that. Like, guys are going to have to stop in the field. They're going to get their whiplash and like, okay, pack up. We got to go to the next one because the moisture just jumped 20 points.
Funny you say that, Matt. I just yesterday was in a field and one of our drone guy that does drone fungicide, he was saying his drone actually it would hit those low spots and just like tank. He was having a really hard time flying his drone because it was trying to sense that crop height. And with the unevenness, it just the drone was even going up and down. So
yeah,
it's funny you even say that, man.
So yeah, so there you go. Just to recap, we got okay crap, fair fodder, roller coaster, contested bronze, and whiplash.
The three guys giving me five options. Right. Can I pitch one out too for you guys just
absolutely.
For consideration?
That sounds great.
And Todd, this is gonna stem from my conversation maybe a couple of weeks ago. Just in terms of each year seems to be one upping the prior year, but I don't know if there was a Seinfeld episode along these lines, or maybe you have a family member at a family reunion, you're telling stories, somebody tries to one up and top, you know, the previous story. I might call this year the topper, just in terms of throwing new and different things at us and seemingly trying to one up what we've done on the prior year. So I'm not going to vote for myself. I'm not that proud, but I kind of am torn between okay crap and contested bronze, you know? So I think I'm going to have to do a split between those two, Bill, that we certainly, as I'm sitting and residing now in Southwest Wisconsin, the roller coaster is a very accurate term. However, we had Raging Bull last year, so fair. I got to take you down a point or two in
that's
terms
fine.
Of the
judges'
panel.
I didn't look the previous year. I just was throwing my...
We'll give you the benefit of the doubt, but that roller coaster is certainly accurate. It is from east to west in Wisconsin, and those of you that are dealing with a roller coaster crop out there, we certainly can use that. You are not alone. But I think we're going to have okay crap. It's a contested bronze, something along those lines,
go.
Right?
There you go.
And we just got to do the best we can with the cards we've been dealt, just to continue being cliche as we roll the harvester out in the coming weeks.
No, I think that's all we can hope for is a fall that maybe doesn't follow the trend of this year. Maybe it's not wet. Maybe we can get some harvesting done on time when we want to kind of save what we do have out there. Because there are, I mean, for all we've talked about, there are definitely fields out there that will do well. And, you know, I think that's kind of been the strategy is save the good stuff, do what you can with the rest. And, yeah, that definitely kind of has been the way this year's been going. So we appreciate your time, John. Thank you for coming on the podcast once again. And thank you, Todd and Bill, for being here today.
Thanks for having us, Matt.
And that's a wrap on this episode of Tilt Talk Radio. Thanks for listening. And as always, happy farming.